Well, thank you very much for the award. I would have come anyway. I was actually playing golf this week, and I saw someone that was coming to this event. They said, so I understand you're getting an award, and I wasn't even aware that there was an award involved. All I knew that this was a terrific venue to give a speech, and the speech I'm going to give tonight is on U.S. economic policy in a global context, and I think you're going to find that this speech is pretty fitting for this venue and this audience. It's obviously a pleasure to be here, and I thank the Foreign Policy Association for inviting me. The association has served for decades as a catalyst for developing awareness and understanding of global issues and for providing nonpartisan forums for informed discussions. So your mission is clearly a very worthy one, and I think now more so than ever. So in my remarks tonight, what I'm going to do is consider the evolution of the global economy over the past several decades, and I'm going to be emphasizing the profound changes that have taken place as a result of the rise of the emerging market economies, or what we call EMEs. In this discussion, I'll highlight how the recent financial crisis and its aftermath have accelerated the shift in the relative importance of the so-called developed versus the emerging market economies. I will then discuss how the global economic system needs to adapt in light of the growing relative importance of the EMEs in the global economy. I will explore the implications of these changes for U.S. economic policy, and I'll also touch on some of the challenges that the EMEs face as they seek to consolidate their gains and sustain their success. I will argue that developed countries and the EMEs need to adjust in mutually supportive ways. In my view, the current relationship between the EMEs and the United States is not sustainable on either side. Not only has an unusually wide divergence in cyclical positions opened up that creates immediate strains, but there are also important structural imbalances that have developed that also need to be addressed. I will close by turning my attention to what can be done to address these cyclical and secular challenges. Although I will discuss the role of monetary policy in this context, I'm also going to discuss what other steps can be taken to strengthen the relationship and make it more sustainable over time. As always, what I have to say reflects my own views and not necessarily those of the Federal Open Market Committee or the Federal Reserve System. So with that important caveat out of the way, let's begin. Over the past few decades, the most salient feature of the global economy has been the growing importance of the emerging market economies and the ever-deepening integration of these economies into the global economic system. A shift towards more market-based and outward-oriented development on the part of the EMEs has enabled hundreds of millions of people across the emerging world to become integrated into the global economy for the first time. The outcome has been a rapid rise in living standards and a reduction in poverty on a scale that I think is fair to say is without precedence in human history. These changes have been most evident in China with the historic transformation that began with the economic reforms of Deng Xiaoping and continues to this day. But the EME story is much broader than China. Over the past decade, for example, excluding China, the emerging world has grown at an average 4.7% annual rate. That's the fastest rate on record. And the EME world is, of course, not monolithic. There are dynamic large economies, EMEs that are broadly complementary to those economies, and some countries that are both less complementary and less competitive than their peers. Happily, I think for the most part, the EME success is proving mutually reinforcing, and we can see that by the growing intra-EME trade. As EME output has grown rapidly, their share in the global economy has increased markedly. EMEs now account for about 38% of global gross domestic product. That compares to 23% in 1990. And it's the EMEs, not the developed economies, that have been the engine of global growth in recent years. For example, during the 2000s, the EME growth accounted for nearly 60% of global growth, compared to about a third and a quarter, respectively, in the two preceding decades. By other measures, EMEs have actually been even more important. For example, if you look at EME growth, it's been very commodity intensive. Thus, while China is still only about two-fifths the size of the United States in GDP terms, it dwarfs the United States in terms of its demand for some key commodities. The growth momentum among the EMEs, I think, is the result of years of tough choices and sound decision-making across the emerging world. policymakers learn their lessons from mistakes of past crises, and they capitalized on globalization and technological change. However, while the rise of the EMEs is due mainly to the efforts of the EMEs themselves, I think the reaction of the developed countries is also important in maintaining an open global trading system and resisting the calls for protectionism. That's been also very, very important. Even before the financial crisis, the sustained dynamism of the emerging economies was bringing about a profound shift in the role of the EMEs within the global economy. The traditional distinction between the so-called industrialized core of the system and the emerging market periphery was becoming harder to justify as an analytical construct. As the periphery took on more weight and became a much more important driver of global economic developments. However, the crisis and its aftermath has accelerated this transition. Although many emerging market economies contracted sharply following the peak of the financial crisis in late 2008, economic activity in the EMEs has since rebounded powerfully. In contrast, the recovery for the developing economies has been very anemic. Economic output for the BRIC countries this year will be about 31% higher than it was in 2007. For the G7 countries, the comparable figure is just 1% higher. The rapid rebound of the EMEs occurred mainly because the locus of the financial crisis was elsewhere, and that helped limit the damage to their financial system and their balance sheets. But many EMEs also recovered quickly because they had the capacity and credibility to pursue countercyclical policies in response to large external shocks to aggregate demand. And they had this capacity really for the first time. On many fiscal metrics, some economies in the emerging world now look to be in better shape than many of those in the advanced world. This challenges the traditional distinction between developed country and emerging market sovereign creditworthiness. Where the developed world still stands apart, though, is in the quality of its institutions, legal and policy frameworks, and the sophistication of its technologies and markets. But even here, the gap is narrowing. The story of the EMEs has generally been an extraordinarily positive one for the world, as hundreds of millions of people have lifted themselves out of poverty. Nevertheless, even before the crisis, it was evident that the relationship between the developed and emerging economies was becoming strained and needed to be adjusted. The status quo would clearly be unsustainable. Consider, for example, the economic relationships between the United States and China that prevailed over the past decade or so. Now, some experts have summarized the arrangements as follows. The United States bought Chinese exports at low prices, which bolstered U.S. living standards and held down U.S. inflation. The United States did not take extreme steps to force China to revalue the renminbi upward against the dollar, and China, in turn, invested its trade surplus and capital inflows into U.S. treasuries in order to keep the renminbi from appreciating too rapidly. The U.S. terms of trade improved as the cost of imported goods dropped, and U.S. interest rates stayed relatively low as China recycled its trade surpluses back into U.S. financial assets. For China, the benefits included strong economic growth, technology transfer, and the creation of many manufacturing jobs. These developments, in turn, helped foster rising living standards and political stability in China. Now, these outcomes were not the result of a deliberate grand strategy. But I think this is a reasonable, albeit overly simplistic, description of what happened. Now, although the pre-crisis arrangements worked reasonably well for a time, the flaws had become increasingly evident. Looked at from the lens of the developed world, the combination of rapid gains in production capacity and relatively repressed consumption in the EME world helped foster a global deficiency of demand relative to supply. In these circumstances, the United States and many other industrialized economies had to sustain domestic demand at elevated levels in order to achieve full employment and to prevent deflation. For the United States, the consequence was elevated consumption, facilitated by asset price inflation, easy underwriting standards for credit, and structural budget deficits. Now, of course, this particular outcome was not preordained or caused by the EMEs. There were multiple combinations of domestic demand consistent with full employment in the United States during the pre-crisis period. For example, the U.S. had adopted different policies. It might have shifted the composition of growth towards more business investment and less consumption in housing. But in a disinflationary global environment, amid chronic EME trade surpluses, the United States could not achieve a high level of employment with a high level of national savings. Looked at from the lens of the emerging world, sustained consumption demand in developed nations induced the EMEs to continue to emphasize investment and exports. This meant that still poor populations did not reap the full benefit of their labors in the form of increases in real income and consumption commensurate with the gains achieved in productivity and outcome. Also, this system led in many cases to poor returns to EME savers. This resulted in part from the cost of sterilizing the reserves accumulated in the process of managing exchange rates and the use of the banking system in these countries as a tool of industrial policy. Now, while it's tempting to draw a line of causation from actions in one part of the global system to others, this is overly simplistic. Rather, I think we have to think about the global economy as a single system with outcomes based simultaneously on all the choices and preferences exerted throughout the system. What is new is that the so-called periphery is now weighty enough to have a large impact on the pattern of economic activity in the core, as well as vice versa. Now, while the outcomes were not caused by currency arrangements per se, it's hard to avoid the conclusion that regimes with limited exchange rate flexibility linked to the dollar at undervalued exchange rates did have consequences. In particular, this arrangement frustrated one channel through which relative prices might otherwise have adjusted in a way to induce more balanced global growth. It is clear that the pre-crisis formula for global growth was not sustainable. This is obvious in the case of the industrialized nations, where private consumption and fiscal deficits reached unsustainable levels and needed to be cut back. Less obviously, this is also the case for the EMEs. As growth strategies that rely on excessive consumption elsewhere in the system are no longer viable. Put simply, we now have a problem of arithmetic, particularly for China as the largest and most dynamic EME. As China becomes increasingly weighty in the global economy, it will not be able to sustain export growth in the high teens annually in a world that is growing, excluding China, at less than 4% a year on average. For China, the business fixed investment side of the ledger also appears unsustainably high as a share of GDP. In this context, China's ongoing rapid accumulation of foreign exchange reserves, which carries real economic costs, seems less a sign of strength than an indication of how difficult it is for China to shift to a different growth path. The financial crisis did not cause the old growth patterns to become unsustainable. They already were. But its aftermath forces us to confront the need for adjustment with greater urgency due to the added imposition of extreme cyclical pressures on what were already unsustainable structural relationships. There are now two additional dimensions to the problem. First, the stress created by exchange rate regimes that link the monetary conditions of economies at very different stages of the business cycle. And second, the need for far-reaching fiscal adjustment in the crisis-hit economies of the developing world, which needs to occur in coming years. Again, to simplify, let's take the case of the United States and China. The Chinese economy is experiencing the pressures of rapid economic growth that threaten to lead to overheating. Chinese wages, especially in the coastal regions, are rising rapidly, and consumers' prices on a year-over-year basis are rising at about a 5% annual rate. In contrast, U.S. inflation is considerably lower, growth is subdued, and the United States is still 7 million jobs short of the peak reached in 2007. In other words, an extreme cyclical imbalance exists between the EME world and the United States. The monetary policy appropriate for the United States is increasingly inappropriate for the vast majority of the EMEs and vice versa. This creates for EME authorities a dilemma that cannot be resolved entirely via macroprudential regulatory policies, regardless of their merit. And EME faces a choice: let its currency appreciate more rapidly and risk losing competitiveness in international markets, or restrain the rise in its currency through intervention and risk inflation. The steps required to mitigate the inflation risk to sterilization can also involve big fiscal costs. Neither option is attractive, though the former option of currency appreciation is much less problematic if other EMEs are willing to go along and act in a similar manner. Meanwhile, we all have to bear in mind that current circumstances put stress on support for open global markets in the developed world. Now, on the U.S. side, the recovery remains distinctly subpar in spite of aggressive monetary and fiscal stimulus. On the monetary policy front, short-term rates remain near zero, and the Federal Reserve is just about to complete its $600 billion Treasury purchase program. On the fiscal policy front, the U.S. government has engaged in a large stimulus program. This supported demand and employment, while the private sector shifted its savings balance into surplus in an effort to repair its balance sheets. However, the large size of the fiscal deficit and the rapid increase in the country's federal debt to GDP ratio means that this is not sustainable for much longer. Ultimately, the composition of economic activity in the United States needs to be rebalanced. There are two issues here. First, the consumption share of GDP may still be too high. Second, the need for U.S. fiscal consolidation implies that there will have to be offsetting increases in investment and the U.S. trade balance as the recovery proceeds. To illustrate the second point, consider the following accounting identity. The public sector balance plus the private sector balance must equal the current account balance. So let's put some numbers to that. Right now, the public sector balance is about minus 10% of GDP. The private sector balance is about plus 7% of GDP, and that equals the current account balance of minus 3% of GDP. Now, if we accept the proposition that the public sector balance over time must move from around minus 10% of GDP to minus 3% of GDP in order to stabilize the federal debt to GDP ratio at tolerable levels, this means that the private sector balance and the current account balance must move by an equivalent 7% of GDP to take up the slack. That is a large adjustment. Assuming that the consumption share of GDP still needs to fall over the medium term, that implies that the adjustment in the U.S. private balance will have to occur primarily in terms of rising residential or business fixed investment. Now, there does seem to be room for business fixed investment to expand significantly when firms become more confident about the economic outlook, provided that the U.S. remains a competitive location for investment. But residential investment is unlikely to decline very much for some time, given the chronic overhang of unsold homes. Now, if these two sectors cannot take up all the slack created by the necessary fiscal retrenchment in the years ahead, as seems likely, then the U.S. trade balance will need to improve as well. This implies that the EMEs will no longer be able to rely on expanding U.S. demand as a key driver of their own economic growth. Of course, this is not just an issue of U.S. versus EME adjustment. Adjustments will also be required in other industrialized countries, too, and not just the deficit countries. There has to be a recognition on all sides that global rebalancing in terms of the composition of activity and growth and in terms of global capital flows is absolutely necessary. Now, fortunately, this is not a zero-sum game. It is in the interest of all sides. However, it's still very difficult to accomplish because it is not in the short-term interest of all interest groups in all nations. This means there are likely to be considerable political obstacles to adjustment in many parts of the global economy. Now, in this process, the United States needs to show leadership in contributing to a smooth adjustment. And in this regard, I think there are a number of actions that the U.S. can take unilaterally and in its own interest that will make this rebalancing process easier and less prone to disruption. As discussed earlier, no issue is more important than a credible commitment for getting our fiscal house in order, but at a pace that does not forestall a sustained economic recovery. What is needed here is fiscal consolidation that begins slowly, builds over time to substantial magnitude, and is difficult to dismantle. In other words, it requires the commitment of both political parties. The decision of how big the U.S. government should be and what functions it should perform is a political decision that I leave to the voters and our legislatures. However, as a nation, we need to acknowledge that we must be willing to pay for whatever government service and transfers we want to have. And we should not assume that an excess supply of global savings will always be available to easily finance our public deficits. The choice of fiscal sustainability is not a political one, it's an economic one. And if we do not act voluntarily and preemptively, the market will inevitably force the outcome later, most likely in a much more difficult and messy fashion. Moreover, we must recognize that the rest of the world is closely monitoring our ability as a nation to come to grips with our long-term fiscal challenges and to pay our debts when they come due. This is an important litmus test of our credibility as a nation and our ability to exercise global economic leadership. But the challenges we face as a nation extend far beyond fiscal policy. We as a nation have to take steps that facilitated the needed structural adjustment of U.S. economic activity that will position us so we can thrive in the next chapter of global economic transformation. We need to make sure that the next business cycle will be more sustainable than the last, which was built on an unstable foundation of asset price gains, easy credit, and outsized financial sector profits. This will require a shift in orientation from consumption to export and investment-led growth. As the EMEs have shown us, comparative advantage and global competitiveness are not inevitable consequences of factor endowments. They are the results of the choices we make as nations. There are no easy answers or quick-fix solutions, but in this regard, ensuring broad access to educational opportunity and improving the opportunities for people to retool their skills mid-career so they compete in a rapid evolving global economy, those are important. So too is ensuring that regulation is calibrated such that it achieves public policy goals in the most efficient manner possible with the least compliance costs and unnecessary delays in the process. A continued commitment to open markets and free trade is essential. Enlightened immigration policies can also play a role, making sure that U.S. companies doing business here in the United States can augment the skill sets of workers here with those attracted from abroad. Tax reform, energy policy, and housing policy also have crucial roles to play, as does financial reform, a subject to which I'll return a bit later in the speech. Leveraging the comparative advantage that the United States has in higher education also makes sense. This should include encouraging foreign students to come here to study. Also, closer partnerships between universities and businesses could leverage the technological discoveries and advances that occur in university research so that the benefits of that research accrue to a greater degree to U.S. firms and workers. These are fundamentally structural issues, not cyclical issues. They cannot be tackled primarily through monetary policy. Instead, monetary policy is mainly a tool for stabilizing the macroeconomy and keeping inflation expectations well anchored. Nevertheless, monetary policy has an important role to play in supporting the transitions that need to take place, consistent with our dual mandate of full employment and price stability. And as we do this, we must take international developments fully into account. The integration of the EMEs into the global economy has been associated with some major shifts in relative prices. For a number of the years, the United States and other industrialized countries benefited from disinflation in manufactured good prices produced in EME nations. This shift in relative prices, a positive terms of trade gain, helped contain inflation. More recently, the disinflationary tailwind in traded manufacturing goods imported from China may have come to an end, at least temporarily, as more of the increase in productivity there is captured in the form of wage gains. Meanwhile, growing prosperity and urbanization in highly prosperous countries, populous countries such as China and India, have been the principal driver of a major multi-year upward shift in the relative price of commodities. This move has been a negative terms of trade hit for the U.S., and it has pushed up the overall rate of inflation, at least temporarily. There are good reasons to believe that commodity prices will not continue to increase at an explosive rate that we've seen in recent months. Households and businesses will adjust their activities in response to the higher prices, and there will be a supply response to higher prices that will gradually build over time. In any event, a shift in relative prices, even if spread out over a number of years, should not be confused with an onset of an ongoing inflation problem. But the uncertain future path of commodity prices does make the task of central banking harder. It's the job of central bankers to ensure that changes in relative prices do not affect the general trend in prices. In the United States, unlike in many EMEs that are appropriately tightening policy, a large amount of slack and low unit labor costs increases provide a disinflationary counterbalance to commodity price gains. Of course, as I noted in a speech earlier this year, we will have to continue to monitor inflation expectations closely to ensure that they do not become unanchored. We also need to keep a close eye on the degree to which unit labor costs in the EMEs and real exchange rate appreciation abroad are passed through in terms of U.S. import prices and into U.S. consumer inflation. Although the historic evidence is that pass-through has been limited in the United States, we cannot be complacent about this. Meanwhile, we have to recognize that monetary policy works somewhat differently in a world in which a large share of global GDP is part of a de facto dollar block. In particular, we must take account of the feedback loops this creates, how U.S. monetary policy influences financial conditions elsewhere, and how these changes in turn influence activity and prices in the United States. At the same time, other nations should recognize that we cannot and do not seek to make monetary policy for the world. Responsibility for ensuring that financial conditions in other countries are appropriate for their own circumstances appropriately lies with their national authorities, and they have a wide range of fiscal, monetary, exchange rate, and other policy tools available for this purpose. I do not see any fundamental conflict between U.S. domestic economic objectives and the interests of the global economic system as a whole. But the existing system of global currency and monetary policy arrangements does render effective pursuit of these objectives more difficult. I believe we would all be better off if the system evolved towards more flexible exchange rates and greater monetary independence in the EME world. Notwithstanding this, we can and do pursue our monetary policy objectives in the United States, ever mindful of how our policy choices affect other parts of the global economic system, recognizing that these impacts will in turn influence U.S. economic outcomes. For the Federal Reserve, pursuing the dual mandate of full employment and price stability allows us to make an important contribution to global stability and growth, ensuring low and stable inflation preserves the purchasing power of the dollar and sustains its attractiveness as a medium of exchange. Supporting maximum sustainable employment means that we also have an important contribution to make to growth. This remains the case even when we're at the so-called zero bound with respect to short-term rates. In this context, I believe that our large-scale asset purchase programs were fully consistent with our global responsibilities. For example, our recent program to purchase $600 billion of Treasury securities sought to prevent a relapse of the U.S. into recession and to lessen the risk of deflation, outcomes that would have been very damaging to the global economy had they occurred. I do not mean to dismiss lightly the concerns raised by some EMEs about this program. By removing long-term duration Treasury assets from private investors' hands, we encourage those investors to purchase other assets, including foreign assets. This eased U.S. financial conditions and thus boosted U.S. demand for both domestically and foreign-produced goods. The portfolio rebalancing also may have encouraged greater gross capital outflows. It is at least possible that this amplified the fundamentally driven rise in EME asset prices and put some upward pressure on EME currencies. But, in my opinion, it would have been irresponsible for us to allow the risk of a deflationary outcome in the United States to persist without decisive policy action. If the United States had slipped back into recession, the global economy and financial system would have been destabilized in unpredictable ways, and capital flight to the EMEs and upward pressure on EME currencies would have likely increased rather than diminished. The Federal Reserve is fully committed to keeping inflation in check and maintaining the purchasing power of the dollar. This is important for U.S. economic stability and growth. It's also critical if the United States is to retain foreign investor confidence, which as an importer of capital, we must never take for granted. In fact, we recognize that the United States as the issuer of the global reserve currency has singular responsibilities within the global system. The central role of the dollar and dollar assets rests on several pillars. Confidence in the credibility and coherence of U.S. monetary policy, which preserves the long-run purchasing power of the dollar. the impeachable credit quality of public debt that anchors our system, the resiliency and vibrancy of our financial system, and finally, the efficiency and security of our payment system. These are strengths that we must constantly maintain. Ensuring financial stability is essential to advancing the common interest of the global economic system, and we have much work still to do in the developed world on this. But the EMEs also need to be active participants in this conversation, given their rising weight in the world economy, their already large contribution to global savings, and their growing importance in the creation of financial assets. Everyone benefits if the EMEs can liberalize and deepen their financial systems in ways that avoid some of the mistakes that we in the United States and others have made. So to sum up, the rapid ascendancy of the EMEs in the world economy and the widespread improvement in living conditions associated with globalization are to be applauded. But aspects of this process have occurred in a manner that have led to strains on both a cyclical and secular basis. The current relations in terms of capital flows and the composition of growth are not likely to prove sustainable on a long-term basis. The issue of global rebalancing has received plenty of attention elsewhere, and my goal today is not to play the blame game. We all share responsibility for addressing this current set of challenges. Whether it's to lay out the reasons why it's imperative for the United States and the EMEs collectively to move towards arrangements that put us on a mutually sustainable path. And I hope I've been convincing in that endeavor. The United States must provide leadership in this global process. This is in our own national interest. The policy response we need combines fiscal and structural adjustments that would enable the United States to prosper in the next stage of global economic transformation. These issues cannot be addressed primarily through monetary policy. However, monetary policy has a role to play in supporting the necessary transitions, and it too needs to be conducted mindful of its global context. As we step up to our responsibilities, we should look to the leading nations of the EME world to provide leadership too, commensurate with their growing importance in the global system, in rebalancing demand, and increasing currency flexibility. If we lead together with mutually supportive actions, we can achieve better outcomes than any of us can achieve on our own. Thank you very much for your kind attention and for the reward this evening.